But we are going to veer slightly off what we have been working on the Radio Free America, and we're going to focus a little bit tonight specifically on, largely on the Rajneeshpuram and the events surrounding the recent closing of Rajneeshpuram and the flight, I guess you could say, of their particular guru from this country. And we're also going to be talking about some possibly related things and certainly about some other what would be called religious cults or whatever, however you might want to choose to phrase them. Of course, one of the ones, and probably the most famous at this point, has been the People's Temple, of course. And we talked at great length about the People's Temple many, many times. And we've done a lot of stuff that, if you're interested, that you could probably track down.
Yeah, in fact, the aforementioned Radio Free America shows, specifically numbers 6, 7, and 8, our last two about mind control, our show about the Martin Luther King assassination, which intersects with Jonestown and a number of ways. Also, a One Step Beyond show from a few weeks ago in which we analyzed the assassinations of George Moscone and Harvey Milk, specifically in terms of and against the background of the Jonestown Massacre. That is also available from DavCorp, and we'll give you the address and so forth later in the program. The show tonight to sort of develop on what Nip was saying in terms of, by way of giving you a synoptic account of it, we're going to be comparing a number of aspects of the Rajneeshpuram and sort of look at that against the background of Jonestown. One of the things that the thing that we focused on primarily with Jonestown was the many intelligence connections. We're going to be looking at Rajneeshpuram in much the same way and asking whether Rajneeshpuram gives evidence of intelligence connections, what those might be, and we're also going to take a look at how the Rajneeshpuram, among other things, may intersect with, of all people, the Hunts of Texas, who we've spoken about so much. And if that sounds far-fetched, stay tuned and, if at all possible, tape what we're about to read you.
That's right. Now, one of the things that we have noticed in the course of our coverage of the ongoing remnants of People's Temple in that particular case is the fact that quite a few people involved in People's Temple have been turning up dead. Of course, those of you who are regular listeners, this sort of pathology or epidemiology, I suppose we could say, is not going to be tremendously unfamiliar. You have seen these symptoms before: major happenstance, a flurry of cover-ups, and then sometime after, people begin dropping dead. I'm not even sure now how many people there are that have dropped dead or been helped to drop dead since the whole thing went down in 1978, but it's at least 6 or 7 or 8 that we've talked about.
Let's say just off the top of our heads, there was a key Jones aide named Michael Prokes who committed suicide shortly after the assassination. Of course, the People's Temple had a hit list. The first person on that was the late George Moscone, and we know what happened to him. And of course, we analyzed a few weeks ago the weak prosecution of Dan White by District Attorney Joe Freitas, and looked at how his attorney, his assistant, the assistant DA, was Tim Stone from the People's Temple. Okay, and the connections between Moscone and so forth we looked at. There was a People's Temple member who then turned to defector and along with her husband wrote a very damning book about the People's Temple called My 6 Years with God. That woman's name was Jeannie Mills, and along with her husband Al, also a People's Temple member, and their young teenage daughter, they were, well, it appears that they were machine gunned. They were certainly shot to death right in Berkeley in an as yet unsolved killing. Another Detroit People's Temple member, a People's Temple member from Detroit, was ambushed shortly afterward. We looked so about a year and a half ago at the death of a People's Temple member named Tyrone Mitchell, who suddenly pulled a gun and started shooting up a schoolyard down in L.A. And recently, not only have we, now of course Larry Layton, who was a People's Temple member and whose family has many, many intelligence connections and connections running back to the guts of the National Security Establishment, since it was decided that he would stand trial again for the murder of Leo Ryan, a number of Jonestown connected people, or people whose work intersected with Jonestown, have dropped dead. A man named Les Ledbetter, who was a national correspondent for San Francisco for the New York Times at the time of the Jonestown massacre, died of ambiguous causes. It's still not clear exactly what he died of, although the initial diagnosis was a drug-related death, although it appears still somewhat ambiguous, and there are contradictions. The following week, the very week that Layton's retrial was scheduled, Forbes Burnham, Prime Minister of Guyana at the time, whose government received concrete assistance from People's Temple, and who in turn was installed by CIA, died after a minor throat operation. And then the week after that, Shiva Naipaul, the brother of V.S. Naipaul, an author who wrote a book called Journey to Nowhere, dropped dead of a heart attack at the age of 40. Those are just the ones I can think of offhand that may not be a complete list.
Although it was V.S. Naipaul who died.
I was wrong. A listener A couple of weeks ago when we talked about it, I thought it was V.S. who died. A listener called me up. It was his brother, Shiva.
Oh, okay, which explains why there wasn't so much coverage. Well, either way, and I, not to sound glib about it, because I have read both men's work, and both of them were fine writers. And if it was, in fact, Shiva Naipaul. Shiva Naipaul has probably wrote even more political criticism than his brother, and he wrote quite a bit about Africa as well as the Caribbean. He was a very interesting character. Okay, well, anyway, as long as we're on this rather depressing litany of Jonestown-related or seemingly Jonestown-related deaths, we're going to read a short article from the San Francisco Chronicle for Saturday, November 16th, 1985. The headline is, Private Detective Slain in San Francisco, Wife Held. And the article is by Carl Nolte, or Nolte, N-O-L-T-E. Says, a San Francisco private detective who played a role in the People's Temple case was shot to death early yesterday in his apartment near Ocean Beach. Police arrested his wife in connection with the slaying. Police identified the dead man as Joseph Mazor, M-A-Z-O-R, age 46, owner of a detective agency called International Intelligence Incorporated. His wife is Nancy Lou Mazor, age 37, also known as Nancy Lou Thomas. She married Mazor a year ago. About 3:30 yesterday morning, police said, she called the Terrible station to say, quote, I just shot my husband. If you don't get here in a hurry, I'll do it again. Officers Mike Gaynor and Ron Barrett went to the Mazor's apartment at 1334 La Playa Street, a block from Ocean Beach. They said they were met at the door by Mrs. Mazor, who had a .22 pistol in her hand. Her husband's body was found lying on a bed, shot once through the chest. She told police her husband had threatened her, but she would not say anything else. Her 13-year-old son by a previous marriage was in the other bedroom at the time of the shooting, but said he had heard nothing. Charles Geary, an attorney who had worked for People's Temple leader Jim Jones, said yesterday that he had been retained by Mrs. Mazor. Skipping down. In 1977, Mazor was hired by defectors from the People's Temple to try to get relatives to leave the temple and Jones, the cult's charismatic leader. Mazor went to Guyana, where Jones and his followers had built a town in the jungle. There, Mazor acted as a liaison between reporters and others trying to find out what Jones was doing. Okay, well, a couple of things to look at here. Obviously, as in so many of these things that we examine, there's no conclusive evidence of anything. It's purely circumstantially interesting to us at this point. However, as happened with the Kennedy assassination and other assassinations, interestingly enough, a whole lot of people way over any broad stretch of the imagination could figure would be within the averages seem to drop dead right afterward, and this is no exception. And as Dave just went down the litany for you, it's a rather long one.
In particular, when any one of these cases is going to be coming to court in any respect, the people really begin dropping dead. As Nip said, the Kennedy assassinations or Martin Luther King assassination would be good to investigate. Also, the Edwin Wilson case and all the people that committed suicide or, as Frank Turpel put it, had hunting accidents in the laundry room of their apartment building is legion at this point.
Right. And so an interesting, just in and of itself has to be examined. A couple of things do tend to stick out here. First of all, of course, as we mentioned, the fact that the reason we're reading this article is this man's involvement with the People's Temple. It is interesting that Charles Geary, first of all, an attorney who had worked for Jim Jones, has been retained by this man's wife, the one woman who ostensibly shot him. Obviously, you cannot tell too much from a story. It sounds a little strange anyway. I don't know if they're implying that her 13-year-old son didn't hear her shoot him, but they suggest that he didn't hear something. But again, an interesting fact that this woman who has shot her husband, who was supposedly helping defectors to get out of the People's Temple and get their relatives out, has now herself hired as an attorney a man who was affiliated with Jones. Okay, so it doesn't sound like she would have met him through her husband, or at least not in any favorable way. Secondly, I may be very much mistaken, and this is totally a shot in the dark, but it seems to me that Charles Geary is a very well-known attorney in the San Francisco area. I would have to imagine that his fees would be commensurate with that. This is not a litigation case where money is going to be made out of it. This is simply a case of defending somebody. It's interesting. One wonders how the wife of a private detective is going to get the money to pay Charles Geary. Again, totally speculation based on nothing but my own questions, but something to think about.
Of course, now remember that one of the things we spoke about in connection with our analysis of the Moscone Milk killings and Jonestown was the fact that Mark Lane, the People's Temple attorney who was going around billing the People's Temple as a paradise on earth, was not only, he has very ambiguous connections. He's now a full-time attorney for the Liberty Lobby, an explicitly fascist organization. And we looked at him as a possible vacuum cleaner. That's a term for an intelligence agent who was installed ostensibly to investigate something. Actually, the person is there to rake in whatever pieces of information outsiders might have. And then the outsiders are then dealt with in whatever fashion the authorities feel is proper. Mark Lane, of course, best known for his criticism of the Warren Commission. His book, Rush to Judgment, was published by Holt, Reinhardt, and Winston, at that time owned by the Murkison brothers, not only linked to the ultra-right in this country, but also implicated directly in the assassination of President Kennedy. And Charles Gary and Mark Lane effected what many people have seen as a rather strange exit from the massacre. Whereas everybody was being shot to gristle, these two guys were able to hot-foot it through the rainforest, allegedly in their underwear, and for a couple of city folks, they fared pretty well out there in the wilds of the Guyanese hinterland. Anyway, circumstances surrounding that have raised a lot of questions. One detail that came to mind as Nip was reading that last article, when the mills were gunned down right in the middle of Berkeley, initially they listed their son as a suspect, and the son was watching television, according to his account, in the house and heard nothing. And later, although they initially listed him as a suspect, they threw that out for lack of evidence very quickly, and the crime is open. And one of the things I remember when the Mills were killed is that one of the things the police removed was a bullet-riddled door, although the Mills themselves, I believe, died from a single wound. Make of that what you will, it suggests at least the possibility that perhaps the Mills found themselves on the business end of a Mitch Worbell toothpick. You know, that much firepower and no noise suggests possibly the infamous Ingram Silence submachine pistol. Anyway, obviously that's speculation, but it's worth noting that as the Larry Layton case comes to trial, the mortality rate among people with connections to Jonestown directly or perhaps with information about it continues to mount. Now, the rest of the program this evening is going to be about the Rajneeshpuram, which, of course, is not only very similar to Jonestown in a number of different respects, both in terms of style and perhaps substance as well. It's worth noting that there's actually a hard connection in that Shannon Ryan, the late Representative Leo Ryan's daughter, is a member of the Rajneeshpuram, and it's sort of ironic that when that came to light, the Rajneesh people were talking all about how this is nothing like Jonestown and so forth. And now that analysis appears to be, at best, premature, because an awful lot of things have happened which not only cast aspersions on Rajneeshpuram, but which suggest possible intelligence connections, and that, of course, is something that we saw front and center with Jonestown. Research credit for the following article goes to Mae Brussel. It comes to us from the Portland Oregonian of Thursday, November 7th, 1985. The story is by Roberta Ulrich of the Oregonian staff, headlined, Followers Plan Guru's Defense. And I'm just going to read you a short paragraph here, and specifically the names of the Rajneeshpuram attorneys. Talking here about a man named Prem Nairan, who is a top legal advisor to Rajneesh. Nairan said four attorneys, two of them former government officials, had been retained to represent Rajneesh. They are Miles Ambrose, A-M-B-R-O-S-E, of Washington, D.C., former Commissioner of Customs. Remember him, we're coming back to him. Brian O'Neill of Los Angeles, a former assistant U.S. attorney there. Peter Shea of Los Angeles, S-C-H-E-Y, who specializes in immigration issues. And John Ransom of Portland. And this is an interesting crew of people, particularly, I don't know about any of the people except for Miles Ambrose, but Miles Ambrose is an interesting person and someone we're going to talk about right now.
And one of the sources that we're going to use in our discussion of Miles Ambrose is a book that we quote and read from, an excerpt from quite a bit here on One Step Beyond. A wonderful book. If you haven't found a copy of it, you'd better get off your duffel bag and go find one, because it's a really, really fine book. And it's a very important thing for any self-aware person to have in the 1980s as we watch Reagan/Ramboism creeping across the country. You might like to know what these folks do in their spare time. Although this specifically talks mostly about the Nixon years, still the connections are still all there, as just mentioned, Miles Ambrose. Anyway, the book is The Great Heroin Coup. It's written by Danish journalist Henrik Kruger, K-R-U-G-E-R. It's copyright 1980 by South End Press in paperback. And again, it's a fine, fine work, and we use it for a lot of different things. And it's just also, it's exquisitely footnoted, too, for those of you who like to go and check these things out. Anyway, now they're talking about 1972 at this time, and the White House they're referring to is the Nixon White House. Kruger writes as follows, The White House now controlled narcotics intelligence at home and abroad. But that still wasn't enough. Now, what they're talking about here is the time when the Nixon administration basically, according to Kruger, and he paints a very, very convincing picture, basically bumped off the old heroin trade coming out of Marseille and things like that, the one that had been run by the Corsican mafia, the Union Corse. But basically what they did was they took it over with American CIA and DEA people and ran it out of the Golden Triangle in Southeast Asia and what used to be called Indochina. So that's what's going on here. It's essentially a nasty little drug war between the Nixon mafia and the old line French mafia. Anyway, the White House now controlled narcotics intelligence at home and abroad, but that still wasn't enough. Nixon's staff also sought to control enforcement itself, and that required effective strike forces. In January 1972, the White House set up the Office for Drug Abuse Law Enforcement, ODALE, O-D-A-L-E, according to a plan conceived by Gordon Liddy. You all remember G. Gordon Liddy. It became the domestic strike force under Miles Ambrose, whose government career ended with news of his pleasure trip to the ranch of a Texan indicted for narcotics and gun running. ODALE soon became notorious for its record of illegal raids, no-knock entries into private homes, and beatings of innocent people. Some called it the American Gestapo. Okay, skipping on a little bit, other stuff about Mr. Ambrose. This is from a footnote in this previous chapter. It says, in early 1980 now, this is just 5 years ago. In early 1980, the Justice Department was investigating allegations that Marcello, and that Marcello is Carlos Marcello, the mafia don, had offered Mario T. Noto, the Deputy Commissioner of Immigration, a guaranteed, quote, plush job after retirement in return for Noto's help in lifting Marcello's travel restrictions. Noto's attorney, ironically, is Miles Ambrose, who stepped down from his job at the head of the BNDD, which is the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, in the wake of corruption allegations. And, of course, those corruption allegations was the visit to the ranch of the wealthy Texan indicted for narcotics and gun running. So we see right here with Miles Ambrose, his involvement with the BNDD and ODALE, the Drug Enforcement Gestapo Strike Force, as people called it, according to Kruger, and connection between this group and then his dropping out after his connections with various drug people were revealed, and his involvement later on acting as a intermediary between a mafia chieftain who himself had been involved in the Kennedy assassination and the Deputy Commissioner of Immigration. So Miles Ambrose gets around, and again, he's part of this kind of strange netherworld that Hogan talks about in Spooks and Kruger talks about in The Great Heroin Coup of semi-official people, or as Henrik Kruger subtitles his book, Drugs, Intelligence, and International Fascism. It's the shadow world. These people flip back and forth in and out of government service, and at the same time, they're lining their pockets with smack profits, basically, and then turning around and deploring drug abuse and demanding more money to set up private armies. And that apparently is the kind of thing that Miles Ambrose has been involved in.
In other words, the drug enforcement machinery in this country is essentially a regulatory agency in effect, rather than a preventive body, in other words, one to discipline the people involved. Anyway, it's important to remember that not only was Nixon's White House, according to Kruger's very convincing thesis, involved in shifting the control of the heroin trade from the Union Corps to the Nixon-linked Cuban Santos Traficante mafia elements, but beyond that, the device for doing this was an assassination team put together involving a lot of former CIA agents, because the netherworld of, again, as Henrik Kruger puts it, drugs, intelligence, and international fascism is front and center here, and specifically Miles Ambrose appears to have been navigating those waters and plumbing them to a considerable depth for quite some time. Miles Ambrose not only had connections with the Drug Enforcement Administration, but he also, or actually its predecessor, the BNDD, he also worked for an organization called Interpol. Now, Interpol is something we've talked about in the past on our programs here, and specifically we had delved into it in considerable length in Radio Free America show number 2, okay? Looking back from 1984, The Hidden History of the Cold War, Part 2. Now, Interpol is actually a private corporation. It used to be called the International Criminal Police Commission. Now it's called the International Criminal Police Organization, the ICPO. What it is a private corporation which consists of a cooperative effort among the police, the federal police of about 100 some odd nations, and they basically have their own international private police force, basically. That's what Interpol is, an international law enforcement agency, a cooperative effort among a number of different federal police. It's worth noting that it is a private corporation, however. It's not a formally established international body. And one of the things that we've looked at in connection with Interpol is the massive involvement of Interpol with fascist elements through the years. During specifically the period of the Third Reich, since by prior agreement, the president of Interpol was always to be, at least for a long time, was the head of the Austrian Federal Police. When Austria became part of the Third Reich, that signaled a succession of Nazi presidents for the Interpol organization. And in turn, Interpol, whose offices were located at Wannsee, the Wannsee suburb of Berlin, which was also one of the key offices for the Nazi RSHA, the Reichssicherheitshauptamt, the High Bureau of Reich Security, that was consisted of the Sicherheitsdienst, SS Intelligence Service, the Kriminalpolizei, the Kripo, and the Geheimestaatspolizei, or the Gestapo, the secret state police. And Interpol was housed at that group. We talked about the Nazi connections of Interpol in our Radio Free America show number 2. Now, in a book which we read then and I'm about to read you some more from, it discusses specifically Miles Ambrose and his role with Interpol. The book I'm going to read you from now is called The Interpol Connection. It's co-authored by Trevor Meldal Johnson, last name Meldal-Johnson, and Vaughn Young. And the book is published in hardcover by the Dial Press, and it's copyright 1979. And one of the interesting things that Miles Ambrose did was to form the working relationship, or well, actually to define the nature of the working relationship between Interpol and the United States government. Although previously Interpol had worked with the Department of Justice, Miles Ambrose set up a pattern of cooperation under which the Treasury Department was the organ of the U.S. government to be officially represented in Interpol. Meldal Johnson and Vaughn Young write about that as follows in the Interpol Connection. By 1957, both Treasury and Interpol wanted the prestige of legal Treasury membership. Miles Ambrose, then assistant to the Secretary for Law Enforcement, approached Hoover to convince him to relinquish the Justice Department's membership, since technically it had ended. Using what he called in an interview his Irish charm, unquote, Ambrose held a series of meetings with Hoover and his staff and persuaded the FBI to allow the change. Treasury also held meetings with the State Department on the subject of official membership. So not only is Miles Ambrose a key official with regard to drug enforcement in this country, but also very much involved with Interpol, an international police organization, a private corporation, which not only during World War II, but as is indicated in this book, for a long time thereafter, through the period we're talking about, the early 70s, The Interpol organization was notorious for the number of former Nazis and Nazi collaborators that were to be found within its ranks. More about Ambrose from the Interpol connection. In 1957, Miles Ambrose was assistant to the Secretary for Law Enforcement. Ambrose left Treasury in 1960 to become director on the Waterfront Commission in New York. In 1969, he came back and headed up U.S. Customs. In 1972, he once again became an Interpol delegate. So Miles Ambrose, not only a key official with regard to drug enforcement, but again, not only a key U.S. Interpol official, but the man who set up the current working relationship, the pattern of the current working relationship between Interpol and the U.S. government.
All right, and while we're talking about interesting people affiliated with the Rajneeshpuram, we're going to talk now about a very interesting gentleman. This article is from The Oregonian for Monday, October 14th, 1985. This article is provided to us by Mae Brussel, of course. Just to mention, as long as I'm thinking about it, since we're always kind of getting this mixed up, it's Mae's name is Mae, and her last name is Brussel, as in Brussels, Belgium. Just because a lot of people are not quite sure, and some of them think it's Mabe, and it's May is her first name. Anyway, okay, the article is entitled, or headline, Fugitive Said Tied to Sect. The article is by James S. Long, or James Long of the Oregonian staff. A Seattle-based federal grand jury investigating West Coast drug dealing is looking into any significance of contacts between a suspected, quote, significant drug smuggler and Oregon members of the Rajneesh sect. Robert Franklin Black, age 44, a suspected cocaine dealer who sources said sometimes used the name Swami Hridaya, was arrested Saturday in Vancouver, British Columbia, on U.S. cocaine and currency smuggling charges, the U.S. Marshals Service reported. Black, an Illinois native, had been on the U.S. Marshals list of 15 top fugitives. An extradition hearing was scheduled Tuesday in Vancouver, but he was said to have waived that proceeding and had agreed to return voluntarily to Seattle. A subpoena issued by the Seattle grand jury was served for guest records at Hotel Rajneesh in Portland about 10 days ago, reportedly as part of the investigation of Black. A few days earlier, a U.S. Marshal had been at Rancho Rajneesh looking for a person authorities described only as one of the Marshal Service's most wanted fugitives. Quote, "We believe Black is a member of that group," meaning the Rajneesh sect, said Joyce McDonald, a spokeswoman for the U.S. Marshals Service headquarters in McLean, Virginia. Bob Christman, chief criminal deputy marshal for Seattle, added, quote, "We think Black has been in and out of the commune several times." He described Black as a, quote, "significant drug smuggler who had been sought since 1975. Prem Isabel, Rancho Rajneesh's chief spokeswoman, said there was no record that anyone using the legal name Robert Franklin Black had ever lived at the Central Oregon commune. She said at least three Rajneesh followers in various parts of the world had used the name Hridaya, but that none of those Hridayas was known to be Black, meaning the last name Black. The Marshals Service released a statement Saturday reporting that, quote, "evidence discovered at the time of arrest indicates a possible link between Black and Rajneesh." The service declined to elaborate. Okay, well, a couple of things to look at here. Not only Robert Franklin Black, a name to be remembered, and his possibility of his involvement with Rajneesh and his apparent involvement in drug traffic, but also notice the fact that his involvement with not just cocaine but currency smuggling. That's something we're going to want to think about, and we'll talk about a little later in the broadcast. But those of you out there who have been following the show over the last couple of years especially will remember a series of articles that we read about a man named Ray Rewald and his involvement with the CIA and his involvement with the CIA station in Hawaii. And the possibility that flight capital from India was being moved through that particular station. Rewald also has been said to have been involved in a variety of other CIA activities, including things to do with the Philippines. But it is interesting to note, and of course we've talked a great deal about other involvements because of the particularly turbulent times they've been having in India lately, but we will go back and look at all these things later on. So just something to think about when you hear about currency smuggling, but of course we're also looking at the drug question right now.
Okay, now it's also worth remembering that, recalling here just for very briefly, some of the things that have come down in relation to Rajneeshpuram. We've looked at in past weeks a couple of things specifically as the trouble began to brew up there. One of the things that came out was, allegations of a hit list that had been put together by members of the Rajneeshpuram, which involved reporters for the Oregonian who had been investigating them and a number of officials who had come in conflict with the Rajneeshpuram in one way or another. It's worth noting in that regard that Ma'anand Sheela, the ex-secretary of Rajneesh, and we're going to talk about the current secretary here in just a second, it's worth noting that she went down to Texas to buy some firearms without serial numbers, which is an interesting little trick. It's also worth noting that she went down to Texas to do that, and recall that Miles Ambrose, the person representing, one of the people representing the Rajneeshpuram, was forced to resign his position with the BNDD after visiting the ranch of a wealthy Texan who was under suspicion for narcotics and gun smuggling. So, an interesting place for her to go. Worth noting again that a whole bunch of people were on this Rajneeshpuram hit list. The hit list reminiscent in many ways of the hit list for the People's Temple, many of whose members are now dead. That is the members of the hit list. Obviously, the People's Temple was massacred in Guyana for the most part. And it's also worth noting, too, that as we evaluate comparisons between the Rajneeshpuram and Jonestown, that a lot of the things that happened at Rajneeshpuram are suggesting at least the possibility, certainly not, it's not definite by any means, but the possibility of employing various relatively subtle techniques of biological warfare and chemical warfare. Specifically here, reviewing a short section from the Portland Oregonian for September 18th, 1985, and again, research credit for this goes to May Brussel. "The crimes Rajneesh said were committed or might have been committed by the deported leaders included poisoning of his physician Devaraj, his former dentist Devagit, and his companion Yoga Vivek. Devaraj said he had been ill three times since June of 1984, most recently after he was jabbed with a needle at the Rajneesh's World Celebration this summer. In that incident, he said he was extremely sick and was hospitalized for 10 days, but doctors were unable to determine a cause. Geets said he understood he was on a list of persons to be poisoned, but he had not been ill, while Vivek said she was sick for about 4 months ago. The poisoning of Wasco County Judge William Hultz in August of 1984. Hultz said Tuesday that the possibility he had been poisoned with a glass of water given him during an official inspection visit to Rancho Rajneesh, quote, has been in the back of my mind, unquote, but that he had no evidence to show the cause of a life-threatening attack of dysentery he suffered 8 hours later. Poisoning of Jefferson County District Attorney Michael Sullivan. Sullivan said he was extremely sick and nearly died, unquote, in February of 1983, but that his illness was diagnosed as pneumonocossal pneumonia, not poisoning. At that time, he was involved in negotiations with the Rajneesh over their use of a state way station on U.S. 97. Attempting to poison the water supply of the Dales, Wasco County District Attorney Bernard Smith said he was unaware of any such incident. Setting a fire that did $65,000 damage to the Wasco County Planning Office, Rajneesh also said that the departed leaders may have caused an outbreak of salmonella food poisoning in the Dales, in which 700 people became ill last September. Obviously not conclusive, but one of the things that we spoke about in connection with Jonestown was the fact that Lawrence Layton Sr., the father of Lawrence Layton Jr., who is now going to stand trial at Jonestown, was at one point in charge of research and development for the U.S. Army's Chemical and Biological Warfare Program at the Dugway Proving Ground in Utah. Later on, he worked for the U.S. Navy's Missile Propulsion Project in Maryland, also appears circumstantially to have worked on a chemical process affiliated with the Manhattan Project. So, again, weigh the charges, that's not established, but the charges of chemical and biological assaults upon various Rajneeshpuram opponents against that background in People's Temple as we draw these comparisons. An interesting person has replaced Ma Anand Sheela, who resigned in the wake of the allegations, some of which we just discussed. This woman's name, and initially, well, she has been married. Her current marriage is her third, and we're going to talk about some of those past marriages. Again, research credit for this article goes to Mae Brussel. This comes from the Portland Oregonian for November 18th, 1985. It's a UPI story, Dateline Rajneeshpuram, and headline, Hasia, a contrast to Sheela. This concerns Ma Prem Hasia, the new secretary to Rajneesh. Skipping down in the article, in a March 1984 interview in the Commune's weekly newspaper, the Rajneesh Times, Hasia said she was born in Paris and spent my youth dodging around Europe, hiding from the Nazis, unquote, who, she said, killed her father. She said she moved to Israel with her mother following the war and enlisted in the Israeli army. They later moved to Canada, where at 19 she married a wealthy 34-year-old engineer. They eventually moved to Tennessee, where he helped build the Atomic Energy Commission headquarters at Oak Ridge, and socialized with the likes of Wernher von Braun, Hyman Rickover, Estes Kefauver, and Howard Baker Sr. Bored with Tennessee, Hasia and her husband moved to Beverly Hills, where she said she lived a life of fathomless bank accounts, maids to grocery shop, and take care of a 35-room house and parties with flower arrangements costing $20,000. After divorcing the engineer in a period of sexual exploration, unquote, she married Al Ruddy, then producer of the television series Hogan's Heroes, and together they produced the movie Little Faust and Big Halsey with Robert Redford and Michael J. Pollard. The Rajneesh Times interview was accompanied by a picture of her, Ruddy, and Redford. She described Redford as a real pro. She said she eventually helped Ruddy produce The Godfather, the Francis Ford Coppola movie that won an Academy Award for Best Picture in 1972. A couple of things are interesting about the background here for Ma Prem Hasia. Now, what is not mentioned in this article is the identity of this 34-year-old engineer who was her first husband and with whom she moved to Tennessee and socialized again with the likes of Wernher von Braun, Estes Kefauver, and so forth. Now, Mae Brussel is a member of a very influential California family, specifically the Magnan family, and because of her family's connections, she is quite well acquainted with many influential conservative people in the Los Angeles area. And Mae's family actually knows knows the first husband here. And the first husband of Ma Prem Hasia is a man named Nathan Glazer. In other words, Ma Prem Hasia was Nathan Glazer's first wife. Well, actually, I don't know if he's married now, but let's say Nathan Glazer was Ma Prem Hasia's first husband. Now, Nathan Glazer is a member of a group of politicos who've been dubbed neo-conservatives, and basically they are extremely reactionary and very close to Ronald Reagan. Specifically, Nathan Glazer is very, very closely affiliated with Ronald Reagan. And again, this is obviously no conclusion whatsoever could be drawn from this. It's worth considering, though, the people that begin to come into focus as we dolly out, as the camera pulls back from the Rajneeshpuram and all the red robes and the chanting and so forth, and we begin to see some interesting people coming into focus, people like Miles Ambrose, a person with, as we like to say here, more connections than a switchboard, connections to the netherworld of drugs and intelligence, and also to Interpol as well. And also we find some people who are not only part of conservative L.A. society here, or have been at one time, but who specifically relate to elements of the national security establishment, such as the Atomic Energy Commission. And, of course, after divorcing Nathan Glazer, the current Ma Prem Hassia went to Hollywood and rubbed elbows with people there. Of course, Hollywood is where Ronald Reagan comes from. Again, I want to emphasize that no conclusions could be drawn from this, but it's an interesting person for the Rajneesh to have as his new secretary. Of course, we've talked many times about Wernher von Braun, one of her former associates and her husband's former associates. Former major in the SS, von Braun is implicated very strongly in the assassination of President Kennedy, and of course, he is the head of our space program. So, again, we're not in any way indicating that this is conclusive, obviously, but again, consider the intersection of all of the different things that we have presented and are going to be presenting. Again, sort of imagine a camera, and as we pull back, take a look at the people who begin coming into focus.
What we've been talking about, and what you no doubt have been listening to, unless you just tuned in which case, too bad, Cookie. We have been talking specifically and mostly about Rajneeshpuram. We did start out the first the broadcast with an article about another People's Temple related or seemingly related death, that of a man named Mazur, who was a private investigator who had had contacts as a liaison between the press and the People's Temple, and also trying to help people get out of People's Temple on behalf of former defectors. And we talked about how he was killed apparently by his wife, and she says she did. She says she killed him anyway. And we talked about all the people dropping dead around the People's Temple case. And now we're talking about a case that may start to have its own list of people dropping dead. Dave just finished reading an article a few minutes ago that listed a lot of people dropping sick in relation to Rajneeshpuram, or at least allegedly so.
And it's also worth noting that the Rajneesh himself said that when they imported a bunch of street people last year to try and swell their electoral strength in Oregon, he testified that Ma Anand Sheela kept all these people drugged, and that one of them was overdosed, and that he died as a result. And he said they just threw his body out of the commune like he was a piece of meat. So at least one death by the Rajneesh's own account.
Okay, now we're going to read an article from... where do we write this down here? It's all over the place. Is this from the Oregonian?
Yeah, what that is from is the Oregonian ran a supplement this past July in which they collated and compiled a whole bunch of articles, a series of articles that they'd done over a period of time. They collated it into one massive little body here, and this is a small portion of that.
That's right, and this is a series of articles from June 30th to July 19th, 1985, when this came out, as Dave mentioned, an Oregonian supplement. This particular article... it's under a heading of For Love and Money, which they're using as a generic for the Rajneeshpuram. This is about Ma Prem Sheela's brother figuring in the purchase of the ranch in Antelope, Oregon, that became Rajneeshpuram, America. Anyway, and they're talking about the actual purchase of this. It gets very complicated, so I'm going to read it slowly. And just to give you a general idea of how some of these things work, and also just about how some of these other names that we've been talking about have begun to crop up. Now, the man Patel, which is a very common Indian name, is Bipin, B-I-P-I-N, Patel, which is Anand Sheela's brother. Okay, and he features in this in terms of getting some of the people, the principals, together, in terms of when the Rajneeshis were first thinking of buying property in America. And the article, again, this is from that supplement from June 30th to July 19th. Okay, Patel contacted a man who was then his commodities broker, Donald J. Weil, age 45, of the Heinold Company in Chicago, for suggestions. Weil said Patel mentioned that he wanted a cut of the deal, quote, a quarter million, but don't tell Sheela, unquote. Weil didn't handle real estate, but he knew a promoter in Athens, Alabama, who might be able to help. He put Patel in touch with Archer Lawson Booth, age 42, whose earlier career in the disco business had ended in flames and an arson indictment. Booth was indicted March 27, 1980, after fire gutted Flutengales, his faltering Huntsville, Alabama disco. Forewarned by a tipster, Huntsville police had staked out the building the night it burned. They saw Thomas Eddie Horn go into the darkened disco and arrested him about 5 minutes later as he fled the flames. Horn told the Madison County District Attorney's Office that Booth had hired him to torch Flutengales. Prosecution files noted that the disco business was poor and that Booth had increased the insurance coverage a few months before the fire. But that wasn't enough to corroborate Horn's statement, and the indictment was dismissed on May 5, 1980. Madison County Circuit Court files showed. The mills of justice grind exceedingly fine, obviously. By 1981, continuing with the article, Booth was, quote, in the business of providing management services to businesses, including real estate and equipment transactions, said a court complaint on file in Chicago. He also was part of the local color in Athens, where he was known among law enforcement officials as a high-stakes gambler. Patel's pitch to Booth was short on details, but the Alabama man apparently sensed a good opportunity. Booth jumped into the Rajneeshee land search with both feet, checking properties in Alabama and Mississippi. The best prospect he found was a 3,500-acre spread in Alabama, a location Sheila rejected because she feared racial problems, Booth said. Skipping along with the article, they're talking about Booth then introduces... Booth gets in contact with a man by the name of James May. May then turns around and says, in June 4th, 1981, referred him to an acquaintance, Alton T., quote, Chimp Robertson. Chimp, obviously a nickname. We hope a nickname. Age 49, a real estate salesman, then with Justice Land Association in Dalhart, Texas. Robertson, this is Chimp Robertson, was the Rajneesh movement's first direct link to the Big Muddy Ranch in Oregon, although thoughts of that property didn't cross his mind in his first conversation with Booth. Robertson had heard about the ranch only recently from a client, Roy L. Ryan, age 53, a real estate broker from Dumas, Texas. Skipping down. Ryan was president of North Plains Land and Investment Company, the Texas corporation that bought the Big Muddy on September 4, 1980 from Reuben W. Evans of Bend. North Plains paid Evans $139,590 and gave him title to a wheat ranch near Waco, Texas. And all the deal was worth $3 million, Evans said. North Plains then mortgaged the Big Muddy for $2.5 million to Mercantile National Bank at Dallas, Texas. Robert E. Harvey, age 33, who was then foreman of the Big Muddy, said Ryan thought he had an immediate resale lined up, but the deal fell through. North Plains was stuck with 100 square miles of Oregon high desert and a $2.5 million loan that came due March 25, 1981. The North Plains loan was nearly 2 months past due when the Rajneeshees appeared on the horizon. After talking with Booth, Robertson mailed off information on several Texas properties that he thought might interest the Rajneeshees. Then he came across the cigarette package with the Big Muddy Ranch notes. Although the ranch wasn't listed with Justice Land Association at the time, he called Booth. Quote, I said, hell, what do you think about 60,000 acres in Oregon? Robertson recalled. He said, hell, just what we want. Booth found Sheila in Phoenix, Arizona, where she and Jayananda were looking for land and persuaded her to go to Oregon. Okay, one of the things that you might want to note there is the involvement of the Big Muddy Ranch property, which later became Rajneeshpuram, the mortgage to Mercantile National Bank of Dallas, Texas, a name not unfamiliar to those of you out there who listen very, very closely and read these things very, very closely. But for most of us who can't always do that, of course, we are along to help out by going back and tracking this stuff down.
Okay, now the Mercantile National Bank of Dallas is owned by one of the biggest of the big Texas money families, specifically the Hunt family that we've spoken about so much in connection with the Aryan Nations broadcasts, with our Radio Free America shows about John Birch Society, and of course the Hunt brothers and H.L. Hunt, the patriarch, figuring prominently in the assassination of President Kennedy. In fact, we spoke about the Mercantile National Bank of Dallas. We didn't actually refer to it by name, but in Radio Free America number 11 about the John Birch Society and the assassination of Kennedy, there is a brief reference to H.L. Hunt. And H.L. Hunt, the Hunt family, controls the Mercantile National Bank of Dallas. That is the bank that held the mortgage for the Big Muddy, which later was to become Rajneeshpuram. small piece of corroboration for the Hunt ownership of the Mercantile Bank. This is from a recent book about the Hunts called Kingdom, subtitled The Story of the Hunt Family of Texas by Jerome Tuchel, or Tuchel, T-U-C-C-I-L-L-E. I don't know how it's pronounced. Book was copyrighted 1984 and published in hardcover by Jameson Books, Ottawa, Illinois. And in Kingdom, Tuchel, I'll call him, writes about the Mercantile Bank and specifically some of its where it is located in Dallas, Texas. And about the events of 11-22-63, he writes, slowly, the presidential motorcade snaked toward downtown Dallas from the airport. The winding gray highway, bordered in green, curved gracefully past a dreary brick building, the Texas Schoolbook Depository, which was located a short distance from the railroad terminal. The depository was visible from the observatory on the roof of the Mercantile Bank building, 10 blocks away, the building where Slim maintained his offices on the 7th floor. Slim, by the way, is Arizona Slim. That's a nickname for H.L. Hunt, which he enjoyed being called by.